Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, big eyes, long necks, and elongated fingers. Okay, well, we're not going to talk about ET, but we do get an expert view on what real-life aliens might look like. Plus,
now, it's held by a magnetic field, and the technology of making that magnetic field is what we've been working on for some time. We now can make very stable magnetic bottles that have very little leakage.
Just how far are we from our fusion future, and how much are we willing to pay? Or is it leaves that are going to hold the ideal green energy solution? Why shouldn't scientists be taught a field of psychology that flies in the face of mainstream science? And turn that frown upside down. Smile and you might live longer. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, everyone. And in the studio with me this week are Nell Bowes from The Guardian and also David Adam. Now, you two, before we introduce our guest, let me ask you a serious scientific question, and you must have thought about it for a long time. If you could choose what aliens looked like, if you could imagine an ideal future when you meet aliens, what would you meet? What's your favourite thing, Nell?
I think my favourite alien is a Clark short story or something, or maybe an Asimov one, where they're silicon-based, so they're actually invisible to humans, but they're completely confused by the idea of these sort of jumbly carbon-based appendages wandering around and actually having something called life, which is great. Then they dissolve at the sound of a scream.
Do they have a name?
Oh, God, I can't remember.
Silicon jumbly life forms.
But they're cool.
David, do you have anything as literary as that?
No, mine's far more lowbrow. I like the dudes out of The Simpsons, the big wobbly green guys with the big helmets on.
Kang, I think his name is, in fact.
With the fang.
The fang, yes.
Actually, technically, I think one of them's Maggie's dad, isn't he? Anyway, sitting in front of me is Lewis Dartnell from University College London, who may or may not be horrified by this conversation, because he's an astrobiologist. Welcome, Lewis.
Welcome, hi.
What did our esteemed panel here make of how do they do when they're describing these aliens?
Well, Nell's hit on a really interesting point there about silicon-based life, that yeah. All life on Earth is carbon-based, but silicon in many ways has got a very similar chemistry, so people do talk about the possibility of silicon life.
Well, we'll talk a bit about what these creatures might look like a bit later on, but as I said before, you're an astrobiologist and you're specifically looking at how things on the surface of Mars might or might not live. You're giving some lectures this week about astrobiology. But let's go backwards a bit. What got you into this? What got you into the study of looking for life elsewhere?
Well, pretty much what Nell was saying as well. Reading a bit of science fiction when I was a bit younger and just having my mind open to the possibilities, things beyond what we can immediately see us around us on Earth. And I was coming to UCL after a degree in biology, and I had some funding made available, and I could choose what PhD I looked into. So I thought, well, now's the chance. I'll try a bit of astrobiology research.
And so where do you start when you look for things like life? I mean, people sometimes think most science fiction novels start with the idea of radio communications from intelligent life forms elsewhere, and we have a program of radio satellites that do this, a SETI. But where do you start when you look for life?
Well, exactly. Essentially, there's two questions. It's looking for intelligent life, or SETI, which is radio astronomy and listening for signals. And there's the more astrobiology end, where it's going out there and being proactive and searching and exploring the solar system and space around us, and building probes to go to Mars, for example, to test the sands that we scoop up in our robotic arms for signs of life. So one of the first things you really need to think about is, what is life in the first place? What is it that makes up life? What does life do? And therefore, how can we build a test? How can we build an experiment?
So you're looking for chemical signatures, that kind of thing?
Yeah, looking for molecules like DNA or proteins, which, as far as we know, could only ever come about through life. Looking for signs of this organic chemistry in the surface of Mars.
The idea of sending something to a planet like Mars is fairly simple, but you couldn't do that for planets in other solar systems or in other galaxies.
No.
And we're finding increasing numbers of planets that might or might not.
Well, yeah,
we've
now discovered over 350 so-called extrasolar planets.
So how do we hunt for life on those planets?
Well, we could even do that telescopically as well. So there's a telescope being launched already called Kepler, which is fully expected to discover second Earth, an Earth-like planet orbiting a Sun-like star, in the next 3 years. And once we've found these Earth-like planets, we can build next-generation space telescopes to look at the light, the sunlight, bouncing off and coming through the atmosphere of these planets, which starts to tell us the fingerprints of the chemistry of its atmosphere. So if you start seeing things like oxygen and methane and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, in the air of this planet, these are thought to be very strong biosignatures, they're called, the evidence of life surviving on the surface of the planet and producing things like oxygen gas, which wouldn't have been there otherwise.
But what makes oxygen in the atmosphere a biocide rather than just oxygen in the atmosphere? Or what makes methane a signature of life rather than just... That's just the way the chemistry of that planet worked.
Well, oxygen's a very, very reactive gas. And if you mix it together with methane in just a couple of 100 years, which is very, very quick on the timescale of the planet, they would have reacted with each other to produce just carbon dioxide. So if you see both of them together in the same place at the same time in an atmosphere of a planet, you know they both must be being produced at the same time by a process. And the only process that really does that in any volume is life. It's photosynthesis and plants producing the oxygen and bacteria producing the methane on the planet.
Okay, so where else should we be looking at? I mean, are we only looking for planets like Earth? Are we only looking at, probably can look at Mars, but you know, are we only looking at those sorts of places for life? Or?
Well, in our own solar system, we've talked about Mars, and that's where I'm focusing. But there's some other potential habitats we think there might be in the solar system. There's an icy moon of Jupiter called Europa, where we know there's a deep ocean beneath the icy surface that has more liquid water in it than all the seas and lakes and rivers and oceans of the whole Earth combined. So this is, again, a very exciting place to be looking for life. Or possibly one of the giant moons of Saturn called Titan. There's a lot of very interesting organic chemistry going on there, although not with liquid water, liquid methane. So it'd have to be quite an exotic life form with some weird biochemistry that we don't quite understand to survive there.
Isn't Europa the place where Arthur C. Clarke imagined there was life in 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Yeah, do not land. Attempt no landings on Europa.
That's right, there's chlorophyll on there. Nell?
I was interested in this idea that you're looking for sort of bodies of liquid or whatever, or water or methane or whatever it is. As that's a more likely place to find life. Because did you write something I saw about whether life could form on a beach? What's the best setup once you've got this kind of planet, Earth-like planet? What's the best setup for finding life on it?
The idea about this beach was we don't really know when, where, or how life got started on our own planet. So it's still a lot of research to be done before we know which are the best environments that might evolve life on another planet. And the idea about beaches on the very, very early Earth is they could be quite radioactive. There'd be a lot of kind of uranium and things left lying around from the formation of the Earth. And this radioactivity could give energy to organic molecules on this beach to get them to start reacting together and build up these more complex building blocks of life, the things that make up our cells. So that was one theory of many about where life, at least the primitive prebiotic chemistry, might have got started on early Earth and therefore possibly elsewhere as well.
Do you give any credibility to the idea that life actually started elsewhere and then was transported to Earth, as some people sort of on the fringes of the astrobiology community do?
There's this idea of panspermia, it's called, where the seeds of life are spread throughout the galaxy. We now know that we have got samples of rock. We've got pieces of rock on Earth. I've held a piece of Martian rock in my hand earlier this year that have been blasted off the surface of Mars as meteorites. And some people claim there's evidence of Martian life inside these meteorites. So we know that at least rocks can be transferred between the inner planets of a solar system. And through other experiments in the lab, we know that life would have a good chance, if it was inside that rock, of surviving.
Were those the infamous NASA meteorites from the mid-90s?
Yeah, this is the Allen Hills meteorite discovered in Antarctica. And then there's a big research program in the mid-1990s that said they found several different lines of evidence for life there. But I think it's fair to say that now the community has stepped back a bit from declaring that there is life in this rock, because each of those lines of evidence could be explained through non-biological mechanisms. So I think the idea is, if you're claiming something as profound as finding life from another planet, you want to make sure your evidence is absolutely watertight. So you've got to rule out every other explanation first. And this is what these scientists are now trying very hard to do with this Allen Hills, and also another meteorite called Nakla from Mars that people think they found signs of life in. So we know that rocks can be transferred between the planets. And so there's this idea that perhaps if life did get started on Mars, it might have started there first, before Earth, and then be transferred across and seeded our planet from a meteorite. So there's this idea, which is interesting but could never be tested, that we might all be Martians ourselves. We've been seeded from the Red Planet.
One of the things you're going to cover in the lecture as part of the UCL Festival is this issue called the three-way chicken and egg problem. Now, I must say, I've not heard of this. I've heard of the chicken and egg problem, but what's the three-way chicken and egg problem?
So when you ask yourself, what is life? You think most fundamentally that life on Earth is essentially a three-part pie. We need to store information so we know how to rebuild ourselves, and that is stored in DNA. We need to provide energy for our cells so they can copy their DNA and run all the processes that go hand in hand with living. So you need a metabolism. You need a way of generating building blocks for yourself and providing energy. And you need a membrane, a kind of an envelope around yourself to stop your other bits drifting apart. So you need all these three things in the same place at the same time to make a cell. But obviously in the origins of life, these things would have been separate. There would have been molecules that could replicate and store information, maybe the precursors of DNA. You would have little pockets of reacting chemicals that would have been very, very simple biochemical networks, but like simple metabolism. And you would have kind of oily bubbles of envelopes that would have been like the membrane. So somehow those three things got together, because without all three at the same time, you don't have a cell that can provide energy for itself and divide. So this is this idea of the chicken and the egg problem that's got three different parts to it.
So does the study of astrobiology, I mean, or will it rather, because at the moment it's still a nascent field, will that give us more information about how life might have started here?
Well, the big hope that I'm holding out, and many other astrobiologists around the world, is that we do find life on Mars. If we find life on Mars, it could be very, very similar to us. It could use DNA and proteins. And that'd be interesting, because it might tell us that there is only one way to build life using organic molecules. So life throughout the galaxy might all be very, very similar to us. On the other hand, if we find life on Mars that's very different from life on Earth, it doesn't use DNA to store its information, it uses things different from proteins, that'd be very, very interesting, because it means there's more than one way to build a living organism. And that would, again, start telling us an enormous amount about our own origins and kind of putting life on Earth into its context within the galaxy.
So, Nell, your silicon-based life form might be real.
Well, I was wondering. I was wondering also with that three-way chicken and egg problem, you're looking at cellular life, but are you not, I mean, things like viral life forms and sort of more basic building blocks surely count as well, don't they?
Do viruses count as a life?
Do viruses count as a life? That's what I want to know.
Well, finding viruses on Mars would be incredibly exciting, because it would mean there would have to be cells there as well, because a virus can only replicate, it can only reproduce itself inside a cell. So you can look for DNA, and if you find DNA on Mars, it doesn't matter really if it's come from a virus or from a cell, because they both tell us some very, very interesting and exciting information.
Okay, well, thanks, Lewis. We'll leave it there for now. If we have piqued your interest, then you can get more by going along to the festival at UCL called The Universe. Lewis himself is going to give a talk called Astrobiology, The Search for Life Beyond Earth, and the festival runs from the 20th to the 23rd of August. Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories this week. Here's David and Nell. News Jack.
Scientists have worked out why the world's highest mountains sit near the equator. It's because colder climates are better at eroding peaks than had previously been realised. The researchers showed that mountain height depends more on ice and glacier coverage than on tectonic forces. In colder climates, the snow line on mountains starts lower down, and erosion starts at lower altitudes.
Could the humble leaf be the answer to the planet's energy problems? Researchers at Imperial College in London are developing an artificial leaf to mimic photosynthesis. They want to take inspiration from the intricate chemistry involved in the process of photosynthesis. This is where plants use sunlight to convert water and carbon dioxide into sugar, and it's the most effective solar energy conversion process on Earth. The untapped potential for using the sun's rays is huge. All human activity for a whole year could be powered by the energy contained in the sunlight hitting the earth in just a single hour.
The love hormone, oxytocin, may also determine how sociable we are. The new research on finches blocked their equivalent of that hormone. That resulted in the birds, which are usually highly sociable, preferring to hang out in smaller groups. This fits with the idea that oxytocin promotes bonding between individuals. It's more commonly known for being released during sex, and it has powerful relaxing effects in humans.
And finally, having a sunny outlook on life can be good for your health. An 8-year study in the US showed that optimists are less likely than pessimists to develop coronary heart diseases, and less likely to die of any cause over the course of the trial. But we shouldn't leap to the conclusion that being optimistic makes people healthier. It could be that good health is what is making people optimistic in the first place, not the other way around.
David, Nell, thanks very much. I just want to say before we talk about the other stories that the mountains one, the one about glaciers eroding the tops of mountains and the mountains around the equator being the highest, this example, the Himalayas, I was very positive about the story, and David, you weren't. You were quite negative about the fact that it might be popular, but everyone loved that story. That the website went crazy for this story. They love the obvious stuff. Do you have anything to say in your defence?
Well, I'll only say that I thought it was a great story, and I'm very pleased that we published it.
Excellent.
I don't understand. Why, if the erosion happens lower down in colder climates?
It starts lower down. If you've got cold climates.
You're cutting the mountains off at the knees?
Basically.
Okay.
This is why lots of mountains in the higher latitudes have such flat tops, because they just don't get high up. Water, essentially, and erosion is a much stronger sort of determinant of the height of a mountain than tectonic forces, which I think is quite an amazing thing.
Who'd have guessed it?
Who'd have guessed it? Who'd have guessed it? Anyway, let's talk about some of the other stories that we actually want to talk about. David, give us some numbers on the optimism study.
Well, overall, they looked at nearly 100,000 postmenopausal women, and they divided them up into were you optimist or were you a pessimist. And they found that of every 10,000 of the optimists, 43 developed coronary heart disease and 46 died. And of every 10,000 of the pessimists, there were 60 cases of coronary heart disease and 63 died. So you can see there that out of every 10,000, there was a difference of 17, which it's a large sample size, it's a small effect, maybe it's statistically significant, but it's not as clear-cut as, say, the effect of smoking on coronary heart disease.
Okay, but I mean, there's some other caveats to list, I suppose, which is that if you're a pessimist, you're not a pessimist all the time, you hope, or if you're an optimist, you're not the optimist all of the time. So how does one define this sort of stuff anyway?
Well, that was rather what I wanted to ask, because how did they define optimism and pessimism in the study? I mean, hand them a glass and some water?
I think it's self-reported, I think, because clearly it's arbitrary, isn't it? You know, you and I might both think we're optimists, but many people would say I'm a pessimist on a number of issues.
Oh, David. We're talking about an association rather than causation here, aren't we? Which is...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it is an association, and then I suppose you try and drill into it to find the cause and effect, but it's probably one that would just be so subtle it would almost be impossible to prove.
Maybe it just links into stress hormones. If you're optimistic, you get knocked down and less stressed out by things happening around you, and you kind of bounce back and look at the silver lining in the cloud, which means your cortisol and you're just less stressed and nervous about things the whole time.
Let's draw this out into its evolutionary sort of side. You know, if you're an optimist, perhaps you get eaten by lions more, so that's why there's not more of us around. I would say I'm an optimist, but if you're always an optimist, and you think, well, actually,
why would optimists get eaten by lions?
Well, you would see a rustling in the jungle, and you'd think, and that's just my friend.
That might be my dinner.
That's my friend or something. But instead of thinking, I'm a bit.
But there's no indication in this study that there's fewer optimists than pessimists.
I was being a bit. evolutionary biology isn't my subject. I'll give you that right now. If Randy was here, he'd put me right.
If I was confronted by a lion, I'd be pretty pessimistic.
You wouldn't know it's a lion. That's what I'm saying. Anyway, fear is a different thing at that point. Which one of you clever people wants to ask me about artificial leaves?
I do. I want to ask you about artificial leaves.
Go on.
So how does it work? What are they actually doing? What's the leaf bit of what they're doing?
What they're trying to do is understand the process of photosynthesis. So how is it that this leaf can trap the light, combine these molecules together and produce organic useful things? And so what they want to do is copy the catalysts inside these inside the leaf, because it's not a simple one-stage reaction. The first bit you have to do is take water and split it into hydrogen and oxygen, which is a fantastically complicated thing to do because it's such a stable molecule. And so the leaf does it with a catalyst called photosystem 2. I didn't ask what photosystem 1 did, but photosystem 2 does this. And it splits water into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen gets released into the atmosphere, which is what we're breathing now. And the hydrogen is what plants use to make things. They combine it with carbon dioxide to make their sugars. And what the scientists want to do is split water and then use the hydrogen either as a fuel by itself, which would be a clean fuel. You could burn it in your petrol tank, or you could put it into a fuel cell and make electricity. And it would be a carbon-free source of electricity. Or you could use the hydrogen with carbon dioxide. And here's the sort of tempting bit. You could use it from the carbon dioxide coming out of power stations or other places. Combine it with that to make methanol, which is essentially a fuel. You could put it into your petrol tank in the way that we put methanol into petrol tanks. And again, completely carbon neutral. We're talking about decades before this actually happens.
I was going to say, this sounds good, but what's the timeline on it?
Well, 10 or 15, 20 years before we get practical sort of versions of this. And then we're talking about commercialization afterwards. But ultimately, it talks to one important thing, which is that whatever technology we have to reduce carbon emissions and so on is going to have to be essentially powered by the sun, because that's our only sustainable source of energy. Everything else is an interim until we get to that. Biofuels or CCS, carbon capture, all of these things are interims until we work out how to do sunlight properly. And at the moment, we do it through photovoltaics, which converts sunlight into electricity directly. But that's very expensive, and it uses silicon, which is it's kind of costly and it's a bit cumbersome. So they want to go right. These scientists want to go right back to the way leaves do it organically and create these molecules, because chemical bonds can contain much more energy than batteries, for example.
I know people have talked about sustainable nuclear power in sort of a similar method, in the idea that you just have banks of power stations splitting seawater using the electricity that the power stations produce to do nothing other than split seawater and then take the hydrogen, which can then be moved around in a way that and stored in a way that you can't with electricity very easily.
This is a good example also of a bunch of scientists who come up with a very poetic name for their subject, because it's nothing to do with leaves really. And you wouldn't really create any sort of thing that looks like a leaf. Essentially, you're creating a big electrical cell.
But to talk about banks of artificial leaves in the desert.
Yeah, absolutely. This is exactly where you'd put them. You'd put them in the desert, they'd harness sunlight, produce hydrogen, and off you go.
Where would you get the water from in the desert?
You see the sea, maybe?
You know what a desert is, right?
you could ring up James Barber, the scientist involved, and just issue this challenge to him. Right, well, you can read more on all of that stuff, of course, at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
It's being built in France and already absorbs half of Britain's energy research budget, but it could make a real dent in the world's energy problems. ITER is the international project trying to develop nuclear fusion into a source of usable power. The technology could transform electricity generation by providing abundant power with no greenhouse gas emissions, and there'd only be small amounts of radioactive waste. One Brit who's part of the project is Stephen Cowley. He's director of the UK Fusion Lab at JET in Oxfordshire, which is one of the leaders in the field.
The device works by holding something at about 150 million degrees with magnetic fields. You make a cage, a bottle, out of magnetic fields that holds something at 150 million degrees is what's called a plasma. So it's very, very hot. And inside that, the deuterium and tritium will bang together, make helium, and release large amounts of energy as kinetic energy of the particles. And so it stays hot because it heats itself, just like the sun does. Now, it's held by a magnetic field, and the technology of making that magnetic field is what we've been working on for some time. We now can make very stable magnetic bottles that have very little leakage. And those are made with big superconducting magnets. So for making this device in southern France, ITER, we have to make basically the biggest superconducting coils that ever been made. And they have to hold the plasma in place while it gets to about 150 million degrees, and then it'll start fusing.
Now, 150 million degrees, that's obviously quite a high temperature.
Yeah, 10 times hotter than the middle of the sun.
I guess the next question for most people would be safety. You know, how is this safe, and how is that kind of heat contained?
So actually, it's so powerful fusion that any one time you're heating about a postage stamp worth of fuel. And you get a lot of energy released by that, but it's only about a postage stamp worth. So if it got released, it doesn't pose any risk, essentially, at that point. So it's an intrinsically very safe way to make energy. It makes a little bit of radioactivity, which decays away in about 10 years to 20 years. It can be put on a site, therefore you could replace existing coal-fired power stations with fusion power stations in the future. It's compact, it can deliver the kind of power that we want, and there's 30 million years of it.
How far are we away from fusion being a power source to power homes and businesses?
That's a difficult question to answer, because actually, you know, with enough money spent, it could be quite soon. The current plan, which is called the Fast Track to Fusion, is to start to produce a electricity-producing reactor in the 2030s. And then after that, of course, it will be a gradual expansion of the business. The slow track would be to scale back what we're doing into a science program, and that would be a great shame for mankind.
When you say money, what are we talking about in terms of the funding you have now and the funding that you would need to make the fast track faster?
Okay, the funding we have at the moment is a little over $1 billion a year in the world for fusion, like $1.5 billion a year for fusion. That has to be contrasted with the energy market, which is $5 trillion a year. So it's a very small amount of the energy market. But it's, you know, if fusion happens, it will be the perfect way to make energy. We have to get this machine ITER built in southern France, because that will make industrial scale amounts of fusion power. At that point, there are no scientific barriers left to fusion. Fusion is essentially done. In the JET device, we did fusion, we got the conditions for fusion, but it wasn't big enough to have a large gain. In the ITER device, we'll have a large gain and it'll be what we call burning. It will heat itself. Let's get that machine built. Let's make it work. While we're doing that, let's get all the technology around it together, and then we'll be able to really take the step forward into electricity when that's done.
Stephen Cowley there talking to The Guardian's Kevin Anderson. You can comment on anything you like or don't like by heading to our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Or you can click on the links there for the Facebook and Twitter options too. Let's have a look now at one of the articles on the Science website. Guardian columnist Chris French has been writing about spoon bending. In the piece, he talked about the idea of teaching anomalistic psychology to teenagers. This would mean A-level lessons on telepathy, psychokinesis, psychic healing, near-death experiences, and talking to the dead. Despite all of this stuff flying in the face of modern science, though, Chris is surprisingly welcoming. Here's what he said. Even if someone ultimately succeeds in producing proof of such phenomena, anomalistic psychologists would still have performed a valuable service by helping them sort out the genuine psychic stuff from the stuff that simply isn't. Personally, I'm not holding my breath. The piece exercised the website's readers too.
Rock Hopper says, half the population believe in paranormal and related phenomena that the other half reject as unscientific. Is this not worthy of study?
Xenocrony says, neuroscientists learn a lot studying optical illusions, or economists studying forms of human irrationality.
But then Lightning 3 comes back with, this seems more rational than religion, which is generally compulsory. Why the furore?
Downface is on the other side of the fence. No! We are indeed all doomed. We could teach them astrology or 9/11 truth theories. How about crystal healing modules in your medical degree? The people who run A-levels should frankly know better.
All right, Lewis, as the resident scientist in this room, what do you think about this? Do you think it's worth teaching psychokinesis and that kind of thing?
I think it's an interesting idea. I suspect it's not so much the exam wouldn't be about what do you know about psychokinesis, write an essay for 10 marks. I think it'd be much more about the critical thinking that this A-level would start trying to teach its students. You do English or history for the way you develop your ideas of rationality and picking apart arguments. I think this A-level would fill largely the same niche as
well. So you're all for it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting.
Yeah, similarly. I mean, you know, it starts from a sceptical viewpoint of going, there's these interesting things that humans believe. Why might they believe them?
So this is a course in philosophy, really, isn't it?
No. It's psychology. It's why do people have this feeling that they have some kind of telekinetic power? Or why? What's the neural basis for that?
I think I'm in two minds about it. I agree that I think it's useful to encourage critical thinking. I just wonder whether, given that time and time is squeezed and science in schools, and maybe we should be focusing more on the core sort of disciplines and teaching people how to be scientists rather than necessarily how to think like scientists. But I don't have a massive problem with it. I can see how it's presented is going to be key. And I think those issues are out there, and it's rather naive of science to say that we're only going to represent the world how we want it to be rather than the world as it is. And, you know, maybe to apply some scientific thinking to issues like this would then allow it to be extended to other issues.
Okay, well, Chris French also posted back on the blog posts, and he said, I personally find the placebo effect and the power of suggestion generally topics well worth understanding. Frankly, he says, I find most of the comments really quite depressing. They seem to reflect the kind of close-minded, bigoted scientism that gets proper scepticism a bad name. So anyway, go read the rest of the comments yourself at guardian.co.uk/science, and you can leave comments there still, I think.
Science Weekly.
Before we finish up, though, let's go back to astrobiologist Lewis Dartnell from University College London. Lewis, you heard our panel's descriptions of aliens right at the beginning, silicon life forms or even Kang.
Green octopuses and Simpsons, yeah.
What are the kinds of aliens that we have on Earth that we don't even know about? I mean, there must be all sorts of weird things.
You're asking about things we don't know about.
Yeah.
The known unknowns.
Okay, let me rephrase that question. That people generally don't know about. I mean, people like you might know about, but people like us don't.
One of the things I'll be talking about in my lecture this Sunday at the UCL Your Universe Festival is what I say is the ugliest life form on the entire planet. And it's called the methane worm. It's a tiny little polychaete. It was found in the deep ocean floor in the Gulf of Mexico. And these things were just found swarming over great big mounds of frozen methane ice, so water ice that's got trapped methane molecules inside it. And these things were not just burrowing into it to make places to live. They were eating the methane. They were digesting and metabolizing that methane gas to power themselves. So they wouldn't have minded so much if the sun had blinked out of existence tomorrow. They'd still be living off this organic gas frozen onto the deep sea floor. So the way of thinking about this, without being too crude, is that there's life forms on Earth that can quite literally feed themselves on frozen fart gas.
But why are they so ugly? I mean, do they just look...
Yeah, they're tiny little worms with hundreds of legs and little tentacles and feelers around the head, and they burrow into frozen ice. And
excellent.
Not the kind of thing you'd want to see on a life scale.
You also talk about the fact that science fiction films don't make aliens alien enough. They're still quite anthropomorphic.
This is something I remember Jack Kern bringing up, of going, why do all aliens have elbows and jaws?
Mr. Spock or Chewbacca, they're some dude with, you know, plasticine stuck on his ears or wearing a gorilla suit. It's mostly for the...
Chewbacca's not real. Chewbacca's real.
But even the alien or predator has kind of thigh muscles. And
yeah. Well, I mean... If you are an organism that has to move around on a planet with things like gravity, then you need to have a skeleton, some way of supporting yourself. You need to have muscles to move that skeleton so you can move around the surface and lift things and, you know...
Could have a helium jump balloon, out of the jungle. Can you?
to float around. Well, people talk about balloon plants. Perhaps, if, as we've talked about already, one of the side products of photosynthesis is hydrogen gas. So if you pump that hydrogen gas inside a stretchy membrane, you can, as a plant, produce a hydrogen balloon and start floating up through the air, perhaps tether yourself to the ground with a vine. So you could float above a forest rather than trying to be really strong and stout and grow up against gravity. So there's nothing in physics or chemistry that would say that's impossible. So perhaps biology on another planet has stumbled across this as a solution to the problems it faces in its survival.
Well, I reckon big bags of hydrogen gas.
You'd have birds going around with pins, wouldn't you?
A lot of flammable danger there. But tell us about the other... Give us a clue about some of the other stuff going on in the festival. There's 3 or 4 days of some quite interesting lectures going on.
Your Universe Festival at the UCL is running from this Wednesday till Sunday, and there's a series of lectures and public lectures that you can look up on the website, www.ucl.ac.uk/youruniverse. And there's a programme of lectures on everything about planet Earth and the solar system and the galaxy and stars and astronomy and what you can see in your own back garden, as well as some live events and exhibitions going on all around North Cloisters and UCL. And these are everything from exhibitions of images of galaxies and how they're crashing together under gravity throughout the universe. There's some activities that would be a lot more fun for the family. We can go along and help build a scale model of the solar system in North Cloisters, as well as a project called Play God, Build the Universe, where there's essentially a clothesline 14 metres long strung out to represent the timescale of the whole universe. And you'll go along with these images and descriptions of different fundamental events in the universe, such as the first stars or the birth of the sun and planet Earth and the origin of life on our planet, and try to put these in order and work out what kind of sequence and, more importantly, what times in the evolution of the universe these things happen at. So that should be a lot of fun.
Excellent. It sounds like Nell's perfect weekend. Well, okay, we're going to wind up there. Thanks to David, Adam and to Nell Bowes for being on the panel. Also, thanks to our guest, Lewis Dartnell from University College London. If you want to get more information about his lecture, of course, as he said, go to ucl.ac.uk/youruniverse. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Also, any suggestions for cracking guests, let us know. Next week, we're at the Wellcome Collection in London, checking out some exquisite bodies. The podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Tiny little polychaete, technically. It was found on the deep, deep ocean floor in the... where the fuck was it found?
Oh, we're going to keep that. We're keeping that. No!